From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
No one should be tried, sentenced, fined, imprisoned, jailed, detained, involuntarily relocated, or deported. We call for amnesty to challenge how the prison industrial complex is used in times of disaster, while structural disasters like racism and poverty continue to be ignored.
Angela Davis on New Orleans, Sean Bell, war and race in the United States, and Somalia. Ethiopian troops have retaken the capital from the Union of Islamic Courts. We'll speak to two experts on the crisis. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Somalia, Islamic fighters have abandoned the capital, Mogadishu, after heavy clashes with Ethiopian forces backing Somalia's government. Over the past week, more than 800 people have been wounded, thousands displaced. The UN is warning of an impending humanitarian crisis as fighting has forced the suspension of aid flights into Somalia. On Wednesday, the African Union called for the withdrawal of Ethiopian and all foreign forces. We'll have more on the story after headlines. Here in the United States, memorial plans are underway for former President Gerald Ford. Ford's body will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol beginning Saturday night, followed by a memorial service at the Washington National Cathedral 3 days later. On Wednesday, President Bush paid tribute to Ford.
We'll always admire Gerald Ford's unflinching performance of duty and the honorable conduct of his administration, and the great rectitude of the man himself. We mourn the loss of such a leader, and our 38th president will always have a special place in our nation's memory.
Meanwhile, a newly published interview that had been embargoed until after his death reveals Ford opposed the Iraq War. Speaking to Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, July 2004, Ford said he very strongly disagreed with the Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq, which he called, quote, a big mistake and unrelated to the national security of the United States. In Iraq, the U.S. military announced the deaths of seven U.S. service members Wednesday. 87 U.S. troops have been killed this month, the second deadliest for the U.S. occupation this year. In other Iraq news, thousands of people demonstrated in Najaf Wednesday against the U.S. military's killing of a top deputy to Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The deputy, Sahib al-Amiri, was shot dead in an early morning raid. The Pentagon says Amiri was responsible for scores of bombings against U.S. and Iraqi forces. But aides said al-Amiri ran an educational organization for orphans and impoverished children and was never involved in illegal activity. Amiri's 19-year-old son, Karar, said he found his father dead on the roof of their home with four gunshot wounds. Meanwhile, Saddam Hussein released a letter Wednesday that's being called his farewell to the Iraqi people. Hussein has lost an appeal of his conviction for crimes against humanity and is set to be executed within the next month. The letter urges Iraqis not to hate the citizens of the countries who invaded Iraq, just their leaders. Saddam Hussein's attorneys say he wrote the letter on November 5th, the day he was convicted for the killing of more than 100 Shias in the town of Dajjal in 1982. In Israel and the occupied territories, Palestinian officials are denying a report Egypt has transferred thousands of weapons to forces loyal to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas with Israel's cooperation. An Israeli official told the Haaretz newspaper the Israeli military helped coordinate the delivery of more than 2,000 rifles and 2 million bullets into Gaza. The weapons transfer was reportedly negotiated during Abbas's meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert earlier this week. Israeli public radio is also reporting a second delivery is scheduled to reach Abbas's forces in the West Bank within the next few days. Meanwhile, Israel's government plan to build a new settlement inside the West Bank has drawn rare criticism from the Bush administration. On Wednesday, the State Department said the new settlement would violate existing agreements and harm future peace negotiations. Israeli officials say the settlement will house up to 100 families who live in the Gaza Strip until Israel withdrew settlements there last year. Israel had pledged to freeze new settlement activity under the U.S.-backed roadmap. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Hamas spokesperson Ghazi Hamad criticized Israel's recent pledge to resume strikes inside the Gaza Strip.
I think it came as a consistent policy for the Israeli government to continue their aggression against our people in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. But I confirm that there is an agreement, which is an agreement for ceasefire. It was approved by all Palestinian factions and also by the government. And we still believe that this agreement is alive, and both sides should respect this agreement because it is interest for our people. And also we have approved as a Palestinian faction that we should work together, and when we want to react, we will react together.
In Argentina, the Supreme Court has ordered banks to repay the life savings of thousands of people locked out during Argentina's economic collapse of 5 years ago. At the time, the Argentine government froze U.S. dollar accounts and forcibly converted them to devalued pesos. On Wednesday, the court upheld the government's right to freeze the accounts, but said account holders must be paid back at the current exchange rate. Back in the United States, months after her resignation from the Bush administration, former Interior Secretary Gail Norton has taken a new job with the oil giant Royal Dutch Shell. Norton resigned in March shortly after her department was linked to disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff. She'll serve as a key legal advisor to Shell's operations on public lands in the western United States. Norton's Interior Department routinely dealt with Shell on issues including drilling in environmentally sensitive areas. Former Senator and Vice Presidential candidate John Edwards is entering the 2008 presidential race one day earlier than he intended. On Wednesday, Edwards' campaign inadvertently posted the news of his candidacy during a test run on its website. Edwards had intended to make the announcement today during a speech in the 9th Ward District of New Orleans. And finally, the body of the late godfather of soul, James Brown, will lie in repose today at Harlem's Apollo Theater. Fans will be able to file past Brown's casket starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A horse-drawn carriage will take Brown's body through Harlem this morning to begin 3 days of wakes, remembrances, and a funeral. Brown died Christmas morning at the age of 73. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Early this morning, Ethiopian troops backing Somalia's transitional government forced militias loyal to the Union of Islamic Courts to abandon their stronghold in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. Over the past week, the number of people killed has been estimated to be as large as 1,000. Thousands have also been displaced since Ethiopia sent 15,000 troops into Somalia in order to fight the Union of Islamic Courts. The Bush administration has openly backed the Ethiopian military and has opposed the Islamic Courts based on alleged links to Al-Qaeda. Weeks before the invasion, General John Abizay, the head of the U.S. Central Command, flew to Ethiopia to meet with Prime Minister Meles Zenawi. Ethiopia has claimed to be protecting its interests in the region. Here is Prime Minister Zenawi speaking yesterday.
We have a mission to do. We have done more than half of our mission already. As soon as we complete the other half, and it won't take us long, we'll be out of there. So they won't have a target to fight against.
The U.S. has long supported the Ethiopian military and in May was exposed as a primary supporter of one of the Somali transitional government's major warlord factions. Much of the international community, however, has not supported Ethiopia's intervention. The African Union and Arab League have called for Ethiopia to withdraw from Somalia. Outgoing UN Secretary General Kofi Annan called for Somalia's neighbors to stay out of the crisis. Last night, the UN Security Council failed to agree to a statement calling for the withdrawal of Ethiopian forces. On Wednesday, the UN also warned of an impending humanitarian crisis as aid flights to the drought-stricken population were suspended as an effect of the fighting. Somalia has not held a stable government for more than a decade. The Islamic Court seized power this past summer from a weak but internationally backed transitional government composed of the country's major warlord factions. Saeed Samatar is with us, a professor of African history specializing in Somalia at Rutgers University based in Newark. He's also managing editor of the Horn of Africa Independent Journal and author of many books on Somalia. He's with us in our Firehouse studio at DCTV. Nia Akwete is also with us in Washington, D.C. He's the new executive director of Africa Action. He's also the founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute based in Accra, Ghana. He joins us in D.C. at the Reuters studio. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Niakwete in Washington, D.C. Can you lay out the conflict as you see it, and especially for people here in the United States who, to say the least, get very little on Africa in the media? Put it also in a geographical context for us.
Sure. Thank you very much, Amy. I think the conflict that's going on now in Somalia has several elements and aspects to it. On the surface of it, it's the struggle between the transitional government of Somalia and the Islamic Courts Union. And Ethiopia has stepped in with the support of the United States, as it was laid out in the background, to support the transitional government, which does have international support, but it is weak. The government does not seem to have the support of the Somali people. The Islamic Courts Union seems to have more support, and they were the Islamic Courts Union actually, to a certain extent, were embraced and emboldened by the CIA's intervention last year when it funneled money to anti-terrorist warlords. Now, in the bigger regional context, you have three other conflicts that are playing a role. There is a conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea. And in fact, Eritrea has been backing the Islamic Union. And then within both Ethiopia and Eritrea, you have repressive governments, you have authoritarian governments who look to this fight in Somalia. They are backing groups rather than dealing with democracy in their own countries. And finally, Ethiopia and Somalia have had a long rivalry over a common area that they share called the Ogaden, and they fought several wars. I know that Professor Samata has written about it and is actually from the area. And so you have a confluence of many different factors. We consider that it is quite a mistake for the United States to so boldly enter the conflict behind Ethiopia, where there are other regional powers who will be threatened by what Ethiopia is doing and will be sucked in, and you get a larger war.
Well, I'd like to ask Said Samatar, what is the interest, not just of the regional powers, but of the great powers that are not in the region in terms of what is going on right now?
Well, I think the guest has explained that one of the principal interests of the West, especially the United States, is the presence of Al-Qaeda-related elements in Somalia, I should say alleged presence, especially people who are alleged to be responsible for the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Kenya and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania in 1998. So that Western forces, Western governments do not want the possibility of the growth of a militant anti-Western base in the Horn of Africa.
But isn't it ironic that for so many years Somalia has been racked by civil war, and at precisely the time when it seemed like there was some stability finally coming into the country, admittedly as a result of the Islamic movements there. Now suddenly the international community wants to step in, and the United States wants to support Ethiopia in entering the country.
Unfortunately, the world does not respond usually out of good humanitarian intention. Sometimes the world does, sometimes the U.S. does. But in this case, my hunch is that the U.S. recognized that there could be a dangerous anti-U.S. terrorist group in the Horn of Africa, and that is what's motivating their renewed interest. It is true that the Islamic courts have done a lot of good. They have stabilized the capital city, Mogadishu. They have restored order, law and order, peace. But they have gone farther by imposing a rigid kind of Islam, which is alien to the Somalis. And in fact, I doubt that the Islamic courts have support from the Somali people now because of their very draconian, harsh kind of Islam on the Somalis.
Do you think that the U.S. should intervene?
Well, the U.S. should not intervene with troops, but I think the U.S. should put its diplomatic backing towards this, behind this weak government, which Ethiopia is supporting. And if I may beg to differ, I do not think that the Ethiopia is driving this move to defeat the mullahs. Ethiopia is supporting Somali troops who came from Puntland largely, and who are the linchpin of the fighting.
Niakwete, your response.
Yes, I mean, it may well be that certainly there are Somali soldiers fighting, but the intervention of Ethiopia is egregious. It should not be there. In fact, the transitional government that Ethiopia is supporting was also supported by the African Union and the United Nations. But Ethiopia's heavy-handed intervention in the fighting has isolated it and the United States. Yesterday and day before yesterday, the African Union, the Arab Union, called for Ethiopia to withdraw because, you know, a few weeks ago, the U.S. Pushed for a resolution in the Security Council that called for peacekeeping troops in Somalia. And it was stipulated that none of the major regional powers that share borders with Somalia should have troops in there. And we are talking especially about Kenya and Ethiopia. Now, if Ethiopia has stepped in against those wishes, one has to imagine what the other powers in the region will be thinking. And I do think that it is a major mistake for the United States to be encouraging Ethiopia to step in such a heavy-handed way. It is not a sustainable solution because, as Prime Minister Meles Zenawi said, they have a mission. When they are done with the mission, they will withdraw. Well, let's say they withdraw in several weeks. What happens then to the transitional government? So this is not a sustainable solution, either by the Ethiopians or by the United States. And I might say that this is just the latest, in our view, of a long series of blunders by American policy in the region, going all the way back to the support of Siad Barre during the Ogaden Wars in the 1970s.
We have Salim Lona on the phone right now from Kenya. He is a former spokesperson for the UN mission in Iraq, a columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya. Salim, welcome to Democracy Now! You've written a piece in the International Herald Tribune called In Somalia, a Reckless U.S. Proxy War. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, let me first address what I just said on your program, which is that this is a blunder and that this is not a sustainable solution. This is actually a crime. Ethiopian forces have invaded a sovereign country. There is absolutely no legal justification. And what's more, the United Nations resolution that the U.S. itself pushed through 2 weeks ago specifically forbids neighboring countries from even joining a peacekeeping force that the region would send in. So this is a crime. It is against the U.N. Charter, and it is explicitly forbidden to send in a neighboring country troops. So that's number one. In terms of the proxy, the headline that was used by the Herald Tribune, it's actually much more than a proxy, in the sense that the U.S. has been trying for many months now to try to undermine the Islamic Courts Union. They have been violating the existing U.N. resolution since 1992, which forbade any armed shipment to Somalia, rightly so. You remember when the 18 American soldiers were killed at that time and the UN peacekeeping mission was terminated. The U.S. has been violating that arms embargo, both by the UN, and using private contractors to funnel arms to the warlords these warlords, most of them are terrorists, and they are part of this government that was based in Baidoa. This government is a government only in name. It was not created by Somalis. It was created in Nairobi, where I am right now, with the help of Kenya and with the help of Ethiopia, primarily through U.S. allies. And it is so weak and divided that it only controls this one town, Baidoa, a very small town. It has not been able to move beyond it. It has had mass resignations from its people. It is not a government. And it is only able to do what it did with the help of the Ethiopians. And I'm sure others have told you on this program that Ethiopia is universally vile in Somalia for a number of historical reasons, including a war that Somalia actually started against Ethiopia to regain the Ogaden that the Ethiopians took from Somalia about a century ago in the colonial period, in the colonial period. So for this government to actually need Ethiopian tanks and Ethiopian troops to come to power, it destroys its credibility. It has absolutely no credibility. So it is a disaster through and through. It is a violation of every, you know, UN resolution that exists so far in Somalia. The new UN resolution says, with the U.S. first of all, ask for a regional peacekeeping force into Somalia in order to, restore peace and stability. I think that's what it said. To restore peace and stability. I mean, the huge irony is that it's under the Islamic Courts Union that Somalia has seen some peace and security for the last 6 months. It is the opposite. What the U.S. Nation is trying to accomplish is the opposite, meaning there will be less peace, less security now that the IUC has been stopped.
Lone, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Salim Lone is a columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya. We're also joined in studio in Washington by Ni Akwete, Executive Director of African Action, and here in our Firehouse studio, Saeed Samatar, Professor of African History at Rutgers University. Stay with us.
Hello, Saeed, if you can hear me.
By Mo Alileche here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about what's happening in Ethiopia and Somalia with Saeed Samatar, professor at Rutgers University of African History, Salim Lone in Kenya, a columnist with the Daily Nation in Kenya, former UN official, and Ni Akwete in Washington, executive director of Africa Action. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to ask Salim Lone, if you could just briefly respond, what about the whole issue of the internationals who have come in on the other side, on the side of the Islamic courts, both Eritrean advisors supposedly, as well as the call that they put out, I think it was last week, for international fighters, Mujahideen, to come to assist them in their battle?
Yes. Well, look, the first thing that's important to keep in mind is there is absolutely no evidence that I have seen or that most people have seen, which indicates that there are Eritrean troops in Somalia. We have not seen any evidence of that. We have seen, of course, plenty of evidence for months about the Ethiopian presence, number one. Number two, this notion of foreign fighters If you know Somalia, and most countries like Somalia, there's plenty of people who are constantly, you know, coming in from Yemen, from Saudi Arabia, from Oman, from Zanzibar. I mean, these countries have lots of close relations, and people are moving back and forth there. So to make a case about terrorists, basically that's what Ethiopia has done, and that is what the U.S. has done as well, to make the case that foreign intervention is needed because there are terrorists there. I mean, this is 100% duplication of what was done in Iraq. There were no terrorists there. In fact, the American action created more terrorists, many more terrorists, and much more instability. And that is what I see happening here. There is no evidence whatsoever of large numbers of foreign fighters coming in just to do this. Yes, it is true that last week, one of the leaders of the Islamic court called for foreign fighters to come in and help them. I don't see anything wrong with them asking for people to come and help defend Somalia, because there is an invasion by 15,000 troops from Ethiopia, an Israel enemy. So if a few foreign fighters come in, that is not the basis on which you make policy. You make policy on the basis of international law, the UN Charter, but most important of all, for peace for Somalia. And that is what Somalia has had for the last 6 months. You know, the U.S. tries to camouflage its, you know, hegemonistic goals by pointing to the need to crush terror. That is what is happening here. They want a client regime. The U.S. wants a client regime in Somalia. Ethiopia wants a client regime in Somalia.
Salim Lone is speaking to us from Kenya. Nia Kwete, your response, Executive Director of Africa Action in Washington. Nia, can you hear us? Well, let's ask Said Samatar.
Well, unfortunately, I haven't quite heard all that Mr. Salim said. But first of all, let's remember, and I'm surprised at myself because I never thought the day would come when I would be defending either Ethiopia's activity or that of the U.S. in the Horn of Africa. But in this case, let's look at the reality. I mean, it may be simple enough to say blatant U.S. doing this, Ethiopia doing that. Here we have got a Somali people who have been terrorized for 16 years and who are yearning, almost crying, to have their state back, to have some semblance of dignity, and they have a government, obviously a weak, dysfunctional government, but nevertheless backed both by the international community, by the African Union, by the United Nations, and by the League of Arab Nations. That government could not govern because you have too chaotic a situation in the country. You have had the warlords. Now the Islamists came in. As I said, they provided a semblance of order in and around Mogadishu, the capital city. Now that weak government, but they have gone farther and imposed a rigid kind of Islam on the country, which the Somalis do not want. And that weak Somali government has invited the Ethiopians.
Nia Kwete, final word.
Sure. I think there are two quick things. Yes, the government is weak, and it was imposed by the international community. It seems to me that what they need then to do is to find domestic legitimacy, and it will seem, therefore, that they should be negotiating with the Islamic Courts Union rather than having Ethiopian come in and cause a war, saying that it will go back very soon. Once again, I have to say that it is unsustainable. And from the point of the United States, it seems to us that this is really a terrible way of trying to fight the war on terrorism. The answer to terrorism is stable democratic states, not by arming warlords. And as Salim Lone said, some of these people that the U.S. has armed are actually terrorists themselves. So it seems to me that even the U.S. trying to protect its interests in the region is going about it in a horribly, terribly bad way, and I don't see how they are going to sustain it. It seems to me they'll make the situation much worse.
Hey, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Nia Kwete, Executive Director of Africa Action. I also want to thank Salim Lone, former UN official who wrote the piece in the Daily Nation in Kenya, and Saeed Samatar, Professor of African History at Rutgers. Thanks so much for being with us as we move on to our next segment. Juan?
My pleasure.
Well, former Senator and Vice Presidential candidate John Edwards has entered the 2008 presidential race one day earlier than he intended. On Wednesday, Edwards' campaign inadvertently posted the news of his candidacy during a test run on its website. Edwards had intended to make the announcement today during a speech in the 9th Ward District of New Orleans. Scholar and former prisoner Angela Davis was also in New Orleans recently. Her visit to the city was in recognition of International Human Rights Day. After Hurricane Katrina hit, many in New Orleans were arrested for looting, left to drown in locked jail cells, and held past release dates. As many as 85% of defendants in the 3,000 criminal court cases still pending in New Orleans qualify for representation by a public defender. An untold number of them have yet to see a lawyer. Angela Davis is an activist and lecturer and a professor of history of consciousness at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her most recent books are Abolition, Democracy, and Are Prisons Obsolete?
Angela Davis went to New Orleans to speak out against human rights violations and demand amnesty for those imprisoned during Hurricane Katrina. She gave the keynote address at a series of events organized by the prison abolition group called Critical Resistance, Amnesty for Prisoners of Katrina, a weekend of reconciliation and respect for human rights. It took place in New Orleans earlier this month. This is Angela Davis. She referred, by the way, to Merlene Mattin, a 73-year-old New Orleans grandmother who spent 16 days in prison for allegedly looting $63 worth of food from a deli a day after Hurricane Katrina hit. This is an excerpt of Angela Davis's speech.
I wanted to focus our attention for a minute on the three incidents in this country recently. Talking about the shooting of that young brother, Sean Bell, in New York on the morning of his wedding. The 50 gunshots that the police admit were shot that day. I'm talking about, Michael Richards? Did you all see it? Because you can actually go online and you can see it. It was much, much worse than anything I had ever imagined. Okay, I'm not going to say anything, because that was, like, really upsetting. And he says, I don't know where it came from. You know. And then there's another instance I wanted to mention. And that involved, it's something that happened in the San Francisco Bay Area where I live. And it involved a Kenyan writer by the name of Ngugi wa Thiong'o. I don't know how many of you have read his work, but he is one of the most revered writers in Africa, on the continent of Africa. He's published, maybe some of you know, I've heard of his book, Decolonizing the Mind. Okay, that's Ngugi wa Thiong'o. He just published a new book, which is really great. I'm reading it now. It's called Wizard of the Crow. He's been on tour with that book, came to San Francisco from Irvine, California, where he's now teaching, and was staying in a hotel, Hotel Vitale, which is one of those boutique hotels, you know, one of those kind of, you know, swanky, sort of small hotels, but Random House was paying for it, right, his publishing company. And so he's sitting there one morning, reading the newspaper, and this employee of the hotel walks over to him and says to him, I am sorry, but only guests are allowed to use this space. Now, Ngugi is, I think, he's probably about 64, 65, and he may have had a sweatshirt on. You know, but, you know, if a white person had a sweatshirt on, nobody would ever assume that he wasn't or she wasn't registered in the hotel. And so Ngugi said to the guy, he says, what makes you so certain that I am not a guest at this hotel? And the employer wouldn't listen to him. And he said it again. And finally, they had to go over to registration. And, well, now there's a big campaign, and the hotel manager has apologized. This is San Francisco, after all. And, and you know, this boycott of the hotel got started really quickly on the internet. And so the manager is saying he will donate money to anti-racist organizations, and he will do this, and he will do that. But the thing is, I spoke to Googie about this, and he said, I kept asking him, what makes you so certain? Because I saw this absolute certainty. Now, the man didn't say, you're black. He didn't say, you know, black people don't belong here. He was just certain that he could look at this man and tell that this man didn't belong there. Just like the cops who shot Sean Bell could look at this young brother and his friends in the club, and he could tell that they dealt in drugs, they were criminals, that they deserved to be shot.
They felt threatened.
Exactly. So I want us to think about this certainty, this self-certainty, as a way in which racism expresses itself. It doesn't have to be about the fact that the person, or it doesn't, there has to be, there doesn't have to be anything explicit about the race of the person. It's just, I know you should not be here. It's like your sheriff said, when Nagin accepted the prisons and the hospitals and a couple of other categories from the evacuation order, apparently at the press conference, Sheriff Gusman was asked to answer the question as to why the prisoners were exempted, and he said, we need to, something to the effect, we need to keep them here because this is where they belong. This is where they belong. They are prisoners. This is where they belong. So I want us to think about this question of racism and this self-certainty. And I want us to ask, where does racism live today? Where did it reside in the past? And how do we identify those spaces that are so haunted by racism today? So we can actually talk about migrations of racism. Because, you know, we used to be able to understand it. We could say exactly what was racist and what wasn't. And now it's not that easy. And that is because racism itself changes. It moves, it travels, it migrates, it transmutes itself. Now, when Hurricane Katrina struck, over 6,000 human beings were locked up in the Orleans Parish Prison. And you know that this is one of the largest city jails in the country. And so actually, I have this quote that Sheriff Gusman said when it was announced that the prisons would not be evacuated. He said, we're fully staffed. We're under our emergency operations plan. We've been working with the police department. So we're going to keep our prisoners where they belong. And this is that same certainty, the certainty of racism, the certainty that appears to be colorblind, but is actually where attitudinal racism has migrated. I think we can discover racist attitudes in that certainty. Orleans Parish Prison was where prisoners belonged under any and all circumstances. They belonged out of sight, away from view. As one of the children said who was removed there from the juvenile facility, we were, quote, treated like trash. Sheriff Gusman was saying, basically, prisoners belong in a trash can with the top closed shut. And so there was this disaster within a disaster, as the ACLU National Prison Project put it, a disaster that we could not see, a disaster that went unrecognized because few people thought that prisoners deserved to be treated as human beings, because few people recognize prisoners as having rights, as having human rights. And so prisoners were locked in their cells and the flood water was rising and there was no way to get them out. There was no clean water. They were forced to drink water with feces floating around in it. We heard about the horrible conditions at the Superdome and at the Convention Center, and they were horrendous. And it's interesting that both of those places were considered, to a certain extent, places of incarceration for a largely black population. But we did not hear about the people being forced to remain in the flooded spaces of the OPP. We did not know that children had been taken there. And if you look at the ACLU's report, called Treat It Like Trash? Abandoned and Abuse. If you look at the ACLU's, I'm not talking about the ACLU, you're right. That's the report about OPP. I'm thinking about the juvenile, that was called Treat It Like Trash, yeah. And then, of course, another 700 or so people were arrested during the hurricane, and Merlene Mattin was one of them. And then they call Burl Cain. I was shocked that he was still the warden of Angola. You know, because I saw The Farm, that documentary, and I read Tom Burgess' book, God of the Rodeo, and read about the way in which Burl Cain tried to get him to share the profits from the book with him before he would agree to be, before he would sign the consent form. And, well, anyway, and if any of you know anything about Burl Cain, you know that, at least in that documentary, he gave the impression that one of his favorite activities was conducting executions in Angola, but holding the hands of the people who were being killed in order to usher them on their way to God. I mean, I know some people in Louisiana are... Well, anyway. Okay, don't let me get started there. Camp Greyhound, when he came to run that jail, that they called Camp Greyhound, they turned the Greyhound bus station into a jail, right? And when I heard about that, I immediately thought about Guantanamo. I immediately thought about Camp X-Ray in Guantanamo. It seems that the authorities here were more concerned with questions of confinement and control and law and order and with security in the negative sense. More attention was devoted to possible breaches of the law than to anything else. And in this sense, you might say that what we saw during Katrina was a local manifestation of the military practices and policies guiding the Bush administration's approach to Iraq. Wow. And to the whole so-called war on terror. Just as anyone who looks Arab or Middle Eastern or who is known to practice Islam is a potential terrorist, a potential enemy combatant. You know, think of all the people who are still locked up in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and all these prisons all over the world because they are suspected of being enemy combatants. Just as Merlene Mattin was suspected of being a looter because she is
Angela
black
Davis speaking in New Orleans. We'll be back with her in a minute.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds rolled in from the north and it started to rain. It rained real hard and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. The river rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood, some people got away all right. The river had busted through, cleared out the plaque of mine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline, Louisiana, Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away, they're trying to wash us away. Oh, Louisiana, Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away, they're trying to wash us away.
Louisiana by Aaron Neville. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we return to Angela Davis, who went on International Human Rights Day to New Orleans and gave the keynote address at an event organized by the prison abolition group Critical Resistance. We'll return now to that address.
When you think about the fact that the sheriff would not even consider the possibility of evacuating the prisoners before Katrina hit land, it was the same kind of racist certainty. When he was confronted with accounts of prisoners in the OPP, Gusman denied their claims altogether, and he said that you don't, quote, and I'm quoting, you don't rely on crackheads, cowards, and criminals to say what the story is. It was the same kind of racist certainty. He didn't say black crackheads. He didn't say black cowards. He didn't say black criminals. But each one of those words is a carrier of racism. And so it seems to me that it might be important for us to think about how the prison industrial complex contributes to and nourishes itself from and lives on racism. Now, I was asked to talk a little bit about the prison industrial complex, but you know what the prison industrial complex is, don't you? You do, don't you? I mean, it's not just all of those prisons that we see all over the country, jails and prisons. It's all of the connections, right? It's the connections that we begin to see in the 1980s when the social programs begin to be dismantled and when globalization of capital begins its ascent. And so capital, money, instead of being focused on the needs of people, increasingly goes into profitable areas. And so there are no resources for health care. There's no resources for housing subsidies. There's no. So then what happens is that these huge surpluses of populations who have no place anymore because there are no jobs for them. A lot of the factories have gone abroad, gone to the global south. And so people have no way to make a living. And so, I mean, it's not as if there was a conspiracy, but it was a kind of systematic conspiracy without people actually deciding that this was what was going to happen. And so the idea is to build more and more prisons to serve as receptacles for those people who no longer have a place because there is no longer jobs for them, there's no longer education for them, there's no longer welfare for them, there's no longer health care for them. This begins in the 1980s, the deindustrialization process, right? And we see it happening right now in the global South. We see it happening in Africa. We see it happening in Latin America. You can go to countries where the poverty is so extreme because the IMF or the World Bank has decided you get a loan only if you can put it into a profitable sector. Not if you want to use the money for schools, or not if you want to use the money for housing. And so what happens is that there are increasing numbers of people in countries in Africa, in Latin America, and in Asia who have become, who are considered to be garbage now. There's no place for them. And so they're building prisons all over. And in some countries, you see abject poverty. And against the backdrop of that abject poverty, you see the shiniest new prison using the most advanced and most sophisticated new technology. All right. Now, something is wrong. Something is seriously wrong. And it seems to me that we see those contradictions right here in New Orleans. And perhaps you've heard about the connection that people often make between the prison industrial complex and slavery, right?
Yes.
You know about the 13th Amendment, right? And we all talk about the institution of the prison being haunted by slavery. I mean, I've heard a lot of talk about ghosts in New Orleans since I've been here, you know. Apparently, the hotel where we're staying is haunted. But I really believe in ghosts. I do. But I believe in the ghost of history. And I don't know if we recognize those ghosts. And I see that OPP and Angola and CYC and or YSC are haunted by slavery. Anybody who's seen the film The Farm cannot help making those connections. But there's something about the ghost of slavery I want to talk about this evening, especially as a way of understanding why black people are so easily labeled criminals, so easily identified with as the threat to law and order. Now, we know that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, right? At least that's what they say. I just can't believe that we believed it. Like, one little statement in the Constitution, you know, in an amendment is going to abolish this huge, complicated institution. And the 13th Amendment doesn't even tell us what slavery is. So it doesn't even say what it abolished. It just says slavery and involuntary servitude. But slavery was a lot more than involuntary, coercive labor. You know, what are they talking about? Abolishing slavery as being based on human property or being based on social death or being based on racism? Because the racism is definitely still here. And the vestiges of slavery are definitely still here. But there's one vestige especially that I think we should be aware of this evening. And that is the extent to which black people, even though we assume that slaves were not recognized as legal personalities, were not recognized by the law, because you know slaves could never file suit or could never testify against anyone. But there were ways in which every single slave was recognized as legally accountable. And that is when a slave committed a crime. Now, if property commits a crime, you see what I'm saying? It can't be morally accountable. It can't be legally accountable. And the fact that there were so many different punishments, punishments for black people who were slaves that were far more severe than for white people who had committed the same crimes. So if you look at that accountability that has always been there, and you look at the fact that there are more black people in prison than any other group of people in this country, it seems like somehow or another, we've allowed ourselves to believe that there was like due process there. And there are reasons why there's so many people in prison. But it seems to me that that when black people became recognized as full citizens or recognized as having standing before the law, it's the same standing that we already had during slavery, and that is that kind of negative standing. The standing of guilt, the ability to be found guilty. And so now racism expresses itself under the sign of equality, under the sign of due process. The negative affirmation of the legal personality of black people continues to hold sway today. And the proof of the participation of black people in US democracy is precisely the fact that they have received due process before being sentenced in such disproportionate numbers to prison. Right. But the prison is the negative side of democratic freedom. Just as slavery used to furnish the evidence of freedom to people who weren't slaves. Yes. Slavery was a way of letting people know who weren't slaves that they were free, right? And in a lot of ways, that's the only way they knew that they were free, that they weren't slaves. Now, the prison does the same thing. We know that we're free because we're not behind bars. And besides, imprisonment has become so profitable. But I think I need to end now because I think I'm still on California time, and I'm going over a little bit the time that was allotted me. So let me conclude by saying that we want amnesty for all the prisoners of Katrina. We want amnesty. We want amnesty for everybody who is doing Katrina time. For everybody who's doing Katrina time. We want all municipal, state, and federal records of prisoners of Katrina expunged. These records should also be expunged from credit and employment agencies. No one should be tried, sentenced, fined, imprisoned, jailed, detained, involuntarily relocated, or deported. We call for amnesty to challenge how the prison industrial complex is used in times of disaster, while structural disasters like racism and poverty continue to be ignored.
Professor Angela Davis teaches at University of California, Santa Cruz. She was speaking in New Orleans. Her most recent books are Abolition, Democracy, and Are Prisons Obsolete? That does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Hugo Caduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Matei, Lee Burek, Chen Yutz, Anna Noguera. Miguel Noguera was our engineer, Micah Filippo as well, Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin. Thank you. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining.